If I bleed tonight, if I am sad tonight, I don't have a job to find. And if I work tonight, if I'm so tired tonight, I'll fall asleep when I'm home. When I'm home. Hey everybody, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Power Slam podcast here on Inside the Ropes. My name is Kenny McIntosh, and I'm not in any way bitter that because a guy in China ate a bat, I can't go to WrestleMania, and I can't be in Tampa, and I can't go on holiday, and I am going to be miserable in self-isolation for the next 3 weeks. But the one thing that gets me through is that I get to talk to my friend and my mentor, Finn Martin. Hi Finn, how are you?
I'm very well under the circumstances, Kenny. I'm here to brighten your day and hopefully everyone's day. Everyone's week, maybe.
You brighten up everyone's year, Finn, just by your mere existence.
Oh, thank you very much.
Does it feel like WrestleMania week?
No, it does not. I think that's one thing that we're all in agreement on.
It does not feel like WrestleMania week. I was talking to Ollie last night and he was saying that WrestleMania is not even a... So, just to kind of give you a little, behind-the-scenes thing. So, when we do our YouTube videos, we do the interviews and stuff like that, and we put them on YouTube. So, we've got a ton of JR clips that we filmed in Manchester with JR talking about different WrestleMania stuff, like his, the greatest match in WrestleMania history, the Austin Rock matches, all that kind of stuff. And when you're putting YouTube videos up, what you do, this is if you ever are going to get into YouTube videos, you want to look for what's trending, right? You want to look for, if you're doing a Jim Ross interview, you want to type Jim Ross into Google Trends for YouTube and see what people are searching for across the world. And I couldn't believe this. WrestleMania is not a trending topic.
Wow.
On WrestleMania week. So that really tells you how, little this kind of, at the moment. Now, I will say this.
And that's weird when you think about it, because there's no sporting events going on. There's no films opening at the cinema.
Yeah.
So, it's not like there's competition from many other forms of entertainment, just TV and streaming services.
Yeah, there's nothing kind of in the way of competition-wise. The other thing that I should mention is that, ESPN in the States, they actually showed WrestleMania 30 last week, and it did 839,000 viewers. So they are taking advantage, I guess, of doing a deal with ESPN where they show a couple of past WrestleManias. But it just doesn't feel like WrestleMania week, But I will say, to WWE's credit, I'm going to be a part of a few conference calls on Thursday and Friday, so they are going to be getting some talent out there to speak to media. And still try and kind of promote the show, which is something they should do. There's no reason why you can't. If these matches are in the can, get an hour with a bunch of talent and put them on conference calls and get some questions in, get people writing articles and putting videos out and getting people talking about the event.
Exactly. What we need is an appearance from Bobby Lashley. Bob needs to explain why he's having this match with Aleister Black. That's what I want to know. Why is this match taking place?
I am not making this up, but on Thursday I am talking to Bobby Lashley.
Fantastic.
So I will. I mean, can you imagine, Bobby? Why is it happening, Bobby? Will your sister Kathy be in the audience? Just the call cuts off.
They should bring that assault course back, shouldn't they, for the Aleister Black match?
Oh, can you imagine? That would be tremendous. We're all in a form of self-isolation right now. I know we're all kind of, either at home or you're commuting just to work and back. So hopefully our podcasts can make things a little bit easier, if you're in a, maybe you live with your partner and isolation is proving that when this is all over, you don't want them to be your partner anymore. maybe you have a boyfriend or a girlfriend who lives somewhere else, and through not seeing them, you've realized that when this is over, you're going to take the bull by the horns and you're going to, get together properly, move in, have kids, or I don't know. There's so much happening.
When this is ended, there's the divorce and probably the birth rate is going to go through the roof.
Yeah, exactly. How many December babies are there going to be? Would it be December? Anyway, whatever month it would be, through this stuff. But we've been doing a lot of kind of podcast stuff on Patreon. Ollie and I are now reviewing TNT, Tuesday Night Titans from 1984. Finn, I watched this week's TNT, which was the July 3rd, 1984 edition of TNT. And do you know who I didn't know was a really good promo?
Who?
Cyndi Lauper. Like, she cut this promo where Roddy Piper goes into the studio to kind of confront her, and she challenges Lou Albano, and she shows more nuance as a character than the majority of performers that wrestle on a regular basis. She sold this idea that Lou Albano, he's trying to say that she's, you know, he made her, and he's trying to say he wrote the lyrics to Time After Time and all this kind of stuff. And she says, you know what, Fatso, I challenge you. I'm going to have a female wrestler. I'm going to bring her. You bring a wrestler. And I'm going to show that you don't know anything about music, much less you don't even know anything about wrestling. I'm going to beat you at that as well. And I was going, who knew? Cyndi Lauper, hell of a promo.
Well, she was a huge fan, wasn't she? She genuinely liked Lou Albano. I mean, obviously, we've talked before on this podcast about Lou Albano appearing in Girls Just Want to Have Fun as Cindy's dad. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, she was a huge fan. I'll tell you who was a huge wrestling fan as well. Debbie Harry.
Was she?
Yeah, Debbie Harry was a huge fan. My other half, she got Debbie Harry's autobiography for Christmas. And there's quite a few items on pro wrestling in there. It's fascinating. Yeah, unashamedly, huge fan of pro wrestling. She got to MSG, they went backstage a few times. And I think she met Gorgeous George. Obviously Gorgeous George died pretty young. I think he died at like early, about 63, Gorgeous George, but she'd met him obviously before he died. And I think when she was working, I can't remember where it was, she was working in some club and Gorgeous George came in. But yeah, she was a huge fan of pro wrestling. So, I mean, it helps, doesn't it? If you understand the business and you want to be there and you want to contribute and this is exciting and stimulating to you, then you're going to, you know, you're going to attempt to want to understand what this thing is that you're doing, and you're going to want to do it to the best of your abilities. So, I mean, I like to think that if I was ever to do a pro, not that I've got any desire ever to have any participation in pro wrestling, but if I did, I would like to think that I would do the very best I could. The last thing I want to do is like cock it up or screw it up for any of the talent. You know, I want to go in there and get it right and do the best I could. So I'm sure Cindy was, you know, that was her mentality towards it as well. That was her whole approach to it. I mean, obviously, back then, you know, she was a huge star. And these events and these programs that she was appearing on were highly, you know, drew huge ratings. That TNT show, as zany as it was a big hit. So, I mean, she knew there's a lot of people watching. So it was, you know, so important for her to get it right, not embarrass herself.
Yeah, she was fantastic. So you can patreon.com/InsideTheRopes. You can go over there and support us in this time where we don't have live events. So, you know, we're not as stable as we'd like to be, but we're, you know, the Patreon helps. Thank you to all of you who have pledged in the last couple of weeks. But you got a lot of stuff over there. You get this podcast a day early. You get, you know, the TNT review. Ollie and KJ do the Pod of Thunder, where they review Thunder for some god-known reason. From 1999 now. Finn's got an article
the wheels have come off by this point, haven't they?
Well, the fact that, like, so, because I did say, so they were watching, like, the end of 1998. And, you know, the whole rule is they can watch Thunder, but they can't watch Nitro. So they have to follow along by watching the Thunders and the pay-per-views. And so I was in to review Starrcade 98, famous show where Goldberg finally loses his streak to Kevin Nash, and there's the big Ric Flair-Eric Bischoff match, and we were reviewing it, and I said, you know what? Because they were very down on the Ric Flair-Eric Bischoff match, because the whole idea was that this was for control of the company. Ric Flair had, you know, been wronged by Bischoff in real life and on screen, and this was the big match at their WrestleMania, and yeah, Bischoff wins. You know, they do a swerve. And they were really down on it, so I said, listen, watch the Nitro the next night, because they actually do a really good main event thing with Bischoff and Flair. So for those 2 weeks, the night after Starrcade, they've reviewed that Nitro, because you have to. And then they had to watch the Finger Poke of Doom episode, because if you don't watch those, what's the point? So I think they're going back to Thunder now. But I mean, early 1990, you've talked about this before, though, that the wheels had not really fallen off by January of 1999. No. The wheels would fall off maybe March, April.
Yeah, February, mid-February is when it really started to go downhill. And by March, April, yeah, things were in, they were in trouble deep by then.
Deep trouble. But the other thing is, so also on Patreon, Sandra and I review Raw and SmackDown from 20 years ago this week. And this Thursday, hopefully Thursday, Friday at the latest, we will be releasing the WrestleMania 2000 review with Sandra, myself and Finn.
Indeed. Yes, looking forward to that one. WrestleMania 2000.
A divisive WrestleMania. A lot of people forget about it. Some people love it. But one of the topics I'm going to bring up to Finn on that episode is that at the time of WrestleMania 2000, WCW was on a 1 week break because they were going to come back with the Russo-Bischoff regime.
Yes.
So we will have a little bit of a chat about that.
The Dream Team. That's how they were viewed. You know, I'm not talking about, you know, the Dream Team of WWF fame, who of course were Greg and Brutus, weren't they?
Then Dino Bravo, if you want to go the new Dream Team.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, obviously some pedant would bring that one up, so I'm glad that you put that one out before someone else did. But yeah, I mean, I'll just say this and then we'll get on to current events. But I remember just before the dawn of a new era Nitro was broadcast, and it had been announced that it was going to be Bischoff and Vince Russo. Bischoff had control, but he was going to let Vince Russo pretty much free reign to run things. People were talking about that as the Dream Team. People genuinely thought that those two might be able to work together. They could coexist and that they could make WCW great again.
I mean, the tagline was there. But I mean, the thing is, and we'll talk about it more in the WrestleMania review, but they actually did have the bones of a good idea. Because if you look at it in wrestling, and maybe there is an example I'm not thinking of. In the time I've watched wrestling, which is from 1992 onwards, I've not really seen in the West, in America and that kind of stuff, I've not really seen an old vets against young guys thing done quite right. It always ends up being that companies either eventually just let the veterans be the guys to kill the young guys, or they get cold feet on what young guys they're going to use. But I think the bones of that as an idea has always been great. It's just it's never really been executed the way that I think fans sometimes would like it to be.
No, I think it's a bit of a fantasy storyline. And it's very, there's lots of reasons why it really, I'm not saying that it couldn't succeed, because it obviously could. Anything in pro wrestling is conceivable because of the scripted nature of the industry. But there are a lot of factors that seem to impede it, which seem to trip that up, which seem to sabotage the whole process of using the old guys to put the younger guys over in a, you know, concentrated storyline like that. Because if you're doing it over the long haul, obviously you can't have all the young guys going over on the first show. It's got to be staggered. It's got to be built up. There's got to be like almost a chain of command thing where the top young guy sort of works his way through the pecking order of older guys until he finally reaches, you know, the head honcho and then defeats him on the big show. So it does take a lot of planning. It takes a lot of discipline from the people in charge, and it takes a lot of cooperation from all involved. And as we know in pro wrestling, it's not really a team sport. It's very much an individual form of entertainment where people are far too often, and certainly this was the case in WCW, far too often they're looking out for number one and finding ways to persuade the person in charge that person who is supposed to defeat him in that big match 6 months down the line isn't really worthy of scoring that victory.
There's no I in team, but there is an I in Kevin Nash. So
exactly, yeah, absolutely. So we will look forward to discussing that on the podcast, which we're recording this Thursday, I believe.
We are, yeah. So let's get to some current stuff. So I want to kick off by the story that broke last Thursday morning, which was that Roman, it was broken by Ryan Satin of Pro Wrestling Sheet, who obviously works with WWE He's on the backstage show, so, you know, this seems like it was kind of their way of saying we want to get this information out there. But for some reason, we don't want to be saying it. So the Roman Reigns was at the PC and around that area because they were filming WrestleMania last Wednesday and Thursday. And Roman Reigns was there. Apparently, The Miz got sick, or The Miz was sick. Something about The Miz being sick. The Usos had an issue with that. And then it all transpired to Roman Reigns kind of going, I don't feel comfortable being here, given that he's, you know, immunocompromised because of his leukemia.
Yeah.
So he removed himself from the situation. He said he couldn't do the match with Goldberg. He couldn't put himself in that position. So, I mean, I think most people who have a brain or a bit of class 100% support the decision that Roman made to not do the match at WrestleMania. But the strange kind of bit coming out of that was that, you know, you watch SmackDown on Friday night and they're still advertising the match. And then they're showing you in full Roman Reigns versus Triple H at WrestleMania 32. And then, you know, even and on from that, we, you know, Raw last night, as we record this on Tuesday, there's, you know, they're still advertising it as one of the matches. And then on Monday morning, very early Monday morning, Triple H was asked, I think I've got the transcript of it here. Triple H was asked on ESPN Sports Center on Monday morning to explain, you know, the Roman Reigns thing. Like, is he wrestling? Is he not? And here's what he had to say. All of our talent are in this in a voluntary capacity. So right at the get-go, if they don't want to be a part of this, if they feel they're at risk, for whatever reason, be it themselves or somebody around them, they don't have to be here, and nothing is held against them for that. Same with our crew and everybody else. But we don't want to take chances on that. And with Roman having a pre-existing condition, that would make him more susceptible to something. It's understandable. We've had very few talent that have had issues or chosen not to be here. I can tell you that. You know, for us, at least for me, an amazing process to be able to go to these events. Everybody's under immense pressure. Obviously, there's a ton of work going into these and trying to do them. Even the talent, performing in front of no one is not the easiest thing in the world. And yet, everybody is here. They just feel a sense of purpose. They're all laughing, they're smiling, they're having a blast. These have been some of the most fun days of television, of everybody just staying within the rules and trying to do it, but happily going out there and trying to perform a service. And I don't think people should look at it as anything more than that. We're trying to put a smile on your face, and if you enjoy it, hopefully you do, and that's great.
He had to get that line in, didn't he? Putting smiles on fans' faces.
Now, so my question to you's got to be, so, you know, I think that they had taped the stuff they were going to use on SmackDown on Friday ahead of time, definitely before Wednesday of last week when they started filming WrestleMania. So they definitely had time to do something. We, out of respect for Andy, who is a spoiler person, we won't say who Roman Reigns' replacement is, but there is a replacement, and Goldberg is facing a replacement at WrestleMania. You can look it up online if you want to know who it is. It's being filmed, it's in the can. But we've had no angle, we've had no explanation on SmackDown, we've had no explanation on Raw. You know, how does this feel to you? Is there a way to sort of like defend them not putting anything on the shows about it? Or, you know, is this really a shady thing that they're doing?
I think as long as they get the word out on Friday, then I don't think anyone will hold it against them. But I mean, to me, you know, they knew when SmackDown went out on Friday, March 27th, and obviously they knew when Raw went out last night, and when they went through the full list of matches, the final one that they announced was Goldberg versus Roman Reigns, and talked about that with the on-screen graphic. He's there still in the video that they're showing. It does strike me as peculiar that they haven't announced it yet. I mean, especially since WrestleMania's starting on Saturday. And they've also been, I'm sure you've noticed this as well, Kenny, I'm sure everyone listening has noticed this as well, they've been really plugging the pay-per-view version of WrestleMania this year, haven't they?
They have, and also, I mean, WrestleMania was announced today that WrestleMania is also going to be available on Fight TV for the first time, which is very out of left field.
So they've been plugging that far harder than usual. Normally, they only talk about WWE Network. You know, go to WWE Network. It's free to sign up, blah, 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 blah. Everybody knows all about that. But this year, they've really been pushing the pay-per-view transmission of the two-day WrestleMania. So, I mean, it's possible, I'm sure, that some people will have already paid for WrestleMania. That sounds feasible to me. Does that sound feasible to you, Kenny?
Yeah. I mean, so yeah, and people
have already ordered it. Placed their order, I guess.
Yeah, because there was a whole chat about what are the pay-per-view companies going to charge, and I think in the end it was like $34.95 per night. So basically, you know, it works at about $70 for the two nights, which is what you would pay roughly for like a big one-night show. So, I mean, yeah, so there's a lot of people who've probably, that's what they're looking forward to the most this weekend. That's their, they're not going out anywhere.
So, I mean, if that match isn't happening, we know that. So why is WWE not alerting those people now before they spend money on this show? Or they may be ordering, I mean, given the mainstream, even though most wrestling fans objected, and we certainly did, objected to Goldberg's return in February and his victory at Super Showdown over The Fiend, there was a lot of casual fans who did have an interest in Goldberg as champ, as evidenced by the rating for SmackDown the following night and the number of people who liked the Instagram picture of Goldberg with the belt. So, I mean, you've got to figure that there will be some casual fans who will have ordered WrestleMania or are thinking of ordering WrestleMania based on seeing Goldberg defend against Roman Reigns. Because, I mean, Roman Reigns, he's like definitely one of the top two, top three stars in the company. I mean, I guess Brock Lesnar's the biggest full-time. Well, no, I guess he's part-timer, but he's more of a full-time part-timer, if you get my meaning. So, I mean, of the stars that are there all year round, I'm Roman Reigns and Brock Lesnar, I would say, the top two stars. So Goldberg versus Roman Reigns is one of the biggest matches that people will be wanting to see and wanting to pay to see. So to me, WWE should be getting the word out as soon as it knows that Roman Reigns will not be on that show. And obviously it already knows because it's already bloody filmed the match in which Goldberg defends the title. So, yeah, I mean, I think they've got to mention this. They've got to reveal this on Friday. They've got to get the word out on Friday.
You'd hope so.
Yes, they've got to. I mean, they should have done it already.
What do you, before we talk about SmackDown and Raw, kind of the last build to WrestleMania, I don't think that we'd had a chance to talk about this last week, but AEW have made the announcement that they are not going to go ahead with Blood and Guts on the, you know, they're basically going to postpone it, I guess, kind of indefinitely until they can get an arena.
Yeah.
Is that a good move, do you think? Is that, should, you know, I guess they actually couldn't do it because Jacksonville, the city, have mandated that it can only be 10 people in one place at one time. So, you know, by the definition of War Games, like, just the 10 people in the match would have been, like, no cameras, no ring announcer. But, I mean, in some ways, that kind of feels like a blessing in disguise that they were kind of, the decision was taken out of their hands, because you've got to think that Blood and Guts would just feel so much more epic if it was done in front of a crowd.
Yeah, it does seem like a waste to me to present that match before we're back in an arena setting with fans, with, you know, an audience. And that's the sort of, that really needs to be their first sort of big show after this whole thing ends. Mind you, aren't they still advertising the Vegas show in May? Are they still advertising
that? They are advertising that, because as of the moment, there are some reports in the States, especially in Nevada and a couple of kind of West Coast states, that things could be opening up again in mid-May.
Okay,
that's the sort of early estimates of when things, you know, that's why in the UK, you know, we've still got the Kevin Owens show scheduled for June 5th, because as of now, there's a chance that June 5th could just be okay, as is, I guess, for them, May 23rd.
Yeah.
Because I think they've cancelled or they've rescheduled all the live Dynamites through the go-home. So I think the go-home to Dynamite is the first one they're due back. I can't remember which city it's in, but until May the 19th, they don't have a live Dynamite in front of a crowd.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, they're still planning on running the pay-per-view in May, but as far as the War Games match goes, I mean, I think they're probably going to be able to keep this feud simmering until then. It just means that they're going to have to delay what's ever going to happen with Hangman Page and Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks. I mean, there's obviously a split coming there at some point. But one imagines that the split will take place in Blood and Guts. I would think that that will be a
perfect time to do it.
Exactly, a vital time to really broadcast that chapter of the story, like the catalyst, whatever events are going to take place, should take place there to separate. I would think that Omega and the Young Bucks are going heel and Paige will remain face, and then he'll be pushed really hard as a babyface. That seems to be the direction of travel in AEW. So they can't, or they really shouldn't do that. And in fact, they can't do that until after they've promoted this double ring cage match. Because those are the two teams, aren't they? It's the elite guys on one side and Jericho and his Inner Circle crew on the other side, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the match. So, I actually wanted to ask you a couple of AEW things as well. Last week, Brody Lee did a segment where he basically kind of, you know, imitated Vince McMahon by, you know, sitting eating steaks and people are trying to talk to him and he's eating steak and he's not interested and he chucks somebody out. And some people quite liked that he was poking fun at it. Some people didn't like it. I just wondered where you kind of sat on, you know, 20 years ago people would hit jabs at each other when they were doing shows. Do you think there's a place for it now?
I mean, to me, it almost seems like it's him venting and him getting this off his chest. And I mean, if this is his act long term, he's doomed. He needs to just, to me, maybe one more week of this and then he needs to move on and come up with original material. It can't just be like a parody of Vince McMahon sitting there in a steak and then when someone sneezes. I mean, fair enough. When someone sneezes in the current climate, chuck them out. You know what I mean?
Burn them at the stake.
Well, that's right. Well, I won't quite go that far, Kenny. No, you were just joking. Well, at least I think you were.
I was joking. Of course I was joking.
But yeah, I mean, Brody Lee's there. He's not allowing other people to eat in his presence. Throws one of them out. You know, he's the cult leader. It's a whole thing of, you know, he's WWE a cult. You know, Vince is the cult leader. And when you're there, you've got to basically all sing from the same hymn sheet. And, you know, any kind of free thought is not only frowned upon, you know, it's almost like a sacking offense. So I mean, so it feels to me like a parody of Vince McMahon. And certainly when one of his underlings sneezed and Brody Lee threw him out of the room, that was a clear direct shot at Vince McMahon. I don't really have a problem with it. I mean, I don't blame Brody Lee for being miffed by the way, you know, his WWE career ended. And really, there's a lot of wasted time there. So, you know, I don't blame him at all for being upset by the way it all was handled by WWE. You know, they were doing that out of spite. They were doing it out of vindictiveness. They were doing it because they could. They were doing it to send a message to the rest of the locker room. Don't start getting any big ideas. We're in charge. We call the shots here. So I don't blame Brody Lee for being miffed. But I think maybe this week, a shot of Vince, and then let's just move on. No more shots of Vince. Let's just see what you've got. Everyone's, as we talked about, I think it was last week's podcast or the week before, we were talking about Brody Lee and it's like, oh yeah, everyone's been saying for months or even years that this guy's been underutilized and he's got all this potential which WWE has squandered. Come on, Brody Lee, show us what you've got. Now's the time.
Yeah, I liked it and I think you're right. I think it's, you know, I think in some ways people kind of, some people will be happy that he had that little dig because he's kind of, you know, held figuratively hostage for a few years, but yeah, you know, it's then going to have to develop into an original character just to have a long shelf life.
Yeah, absolutely, and show some imagination, and also I think you know that bitterness, if it lingers, it can end up working against the talent. I think if he's still doing this in 3 or 4 weeks' time, people are going to be thinking, just turn it in, mate. You know, okay, you know, we get the message. You're pissed off with WWE, but you're not there anymore. You're in AEW now. So let's, you know, you need to move on just as the rest of us want to.
AEW announced last night on their Road to Dynamite web series that they will be crowning a new champion in Las Vegas on May 23rd because they are, they're crowning the new TNT champion. They're going to be having a TNT championship that they are going to be having a tournament to determine the new champ. It begins on April the 8th in Dynamite, an 8-man single elimination tournament culminating with the final match at Double or Nothing in Las Vegas. So the TNA Championship is going to be their mid-card title. Do you think they needed a mid-card title at this point? Is this a good move? Does it open things up for more performers who, you know, realistically are not going to be guys that are going to be beating Moxley or Jericho anytime soon?
I guess it's like their equivalent of the old TV title, isn't it? The old television title. With a modern name, which I think is good as well, because if they called it the television title, that feels really dated. So by calling it the TNT title, I think that has more of a modern twist on it. It all depends on how they book it, and it all depends on how it's treated and how it's received. And it's like any title, as long as you don't have too many titles, any title can be valuable. It can have prestige if the company and the performers who vie for it tell us that it's prestigious. And by their actions, not just tell us, but by their actions, prove that it is prestigious. So I think it can be very valuable. It can be an asset to AEW on the Dynamite broadcast and on the pay-per-views if it is, you know, treated as something that really matters. I mean, there's numerous examples all the over the years of titles that you had high hopes for, which just didn't really matter at all. And then other titles which you thought, well, is this such a good idea? Like, for instance, the IWGP Intercontinental title. When that was invented, I was thinking, is this such a good idea? And it absolutely has been a tremendous idea. Very prestigious belt, because New Japan has made it so. So it's up to AEW to do that with it, this TNT title. I don't know whether they're going to do that or they're not. I have no idea. I mean, it's been hit and miss with AEW on mid-level stuff. I mean, as we know, they've got a lot of things right in AEW, but there's quite a few things as well that are in need of improvement. I think it will start strong because tournaments always are attention grabbers. But it's how it's booked after that, and having, you know, the contenders all lined up and working out where it's going. But I mean, I think it will be all right, but we'll have to wait and see. I mean, it's up to AEW and the talent to make it work. What do you think?
I think it's needed. I think it's good. I think that this is a title that people like Darby and Sammy Guevara and all those kind of guys can fight for. It's a belt that finally, you know, you can have people like Sonny Kiss and people who aren't really featured in a match where you could kind of justify it, if that makes sense. Because, like, you're not putting Sonny Kiss in a match with Moxley for the AEW title. But if there's a mid-card title, then, you know, that's a good way to do it.
If you remember, I'm sure you do, Kenny. I mean, once upon a time, if you were Intercontinental Champion, that was seen as the stepping stone to the heavyweight title, wasn't it?
Yeah. And you know, I could even see them doing a thing where Jericho wants to win the TNT Championship because he was the first ever world champion there. He wants to be the first ever TNT champion. You know, imagine how much of a big moment it would be if somebody like Darby Allin or something beat Chris Jericho in the finals and won the title. There's big moments to have. You might not want to put the world title on Matt Hardy, but maybe one day the TNT title is something that would, you know, be better. I did actually, I saw a tweet from Shane Helms, the Hurricane, which made me laugh, where he said that back in 2006, when he was the Cruiserweight champion in WWE, that he pitched to Vince McMahon if they could call it the CW Championship because they were on the CW network. And Vince apparently said, why would we do that? So he just never mentioned it again. But he clarified later, he wasn't taking a jab at AEW, he was just saying, the CW Championship didn't sound very cool. But the TNT Championship does sound kind of cool. You know, it's got a bit of ring to it, rolls off the tongue a little bit better, so...
I mean, it sounds explosive, doesn't it, Kenny?
It does what it says in the tin. And I hope that the... I mean, again, this is one of those things where, like, if they're doing a tournament, you just hope that the finals of the tournament, when you crown that new champion, will be in front of a crowd, and you can, you know, play that moment back, and it'll get the kind of prestige that it deserves. If you can't tell that I'm tired of empty arena shows, ladies and gentlemen, I am officially tired of them. Oh, dear God. So, speaking of which, we got the final build. Well, not the final. The final build for Raw, but the penultimate build for SmackDown for WrestleMania. Talk about SmackDown first. Obviously, we had the Roman Reigns Triple H match from WrestleMania 32 on the card. But you know, we had a Firefly Funhouse with Bray challenging Cena to a Funhouse match. What did you think of the original content they put out on Friday, minus the fact they promoted a title match that's no longer happening?
Well, I've got to say, Kenny, that I did think of you in that opening segment. You know, Bayley and Sasha Banks came out. Bayley was saying that her and Sasha Banks are better together. You know, they're a united team, or at least Bayley thought they were. Sasha refused to echo those sentiments, or maybe she was about to, but then
they were interrupted by Lacey Evans.
Lacey Evans interrupted them by Naomi, and then they came out, and then finally,
save the best till last.
Saving the best till last. Tamina walked out. She got in the ring. She had a microphone. I was thinking, my God, this is a momentous occasion. This is a milestone. Tamina is going to speak. And wow, what a promo. She said, actions speak louder than words. And then Tamina effortlessly laid out Lacey and Naomi, and then Bayley and Banksy just bailed. They did one. They went into retreat.
Bayley and Banksy, that needs to be their new name.
They fled from Tamina. And I just thought to myself, have I missed something here? When did Tamina become this tough? She's now like the hardest woman in that locker room.
Well, I mean, yeah, in more ways than one. But anyway, but the thing about this that was so baffling was, okay, so Lacey Evans, she's not ready yet, but there's something there. You get why she's there. Naomi, she does appeal to a large demographic of you know, female viewers and stuff, so she absolutely has her place or whatever. Yeah. But to see them both laid out by fucking Tamina Snuka. Oh, it's 2020!
Just incredible. You know, and I'm not referring to that guy from ECW. I mean, it's just like,
When did she date? I'm gonna look this up. I wonder what year she debuted in WWE on the main roster.
When was the last time we saw her on, like, Raw, or saw her on like anything other than like main event or something that no one watches? I mean, was it Royal Rumble? I'm trying to work out when the last time I saw her was.
Let me check, because I know she was out injured for like a year.
I mean, she was in the Rumble, very briefly in the Royal Rumble, and it was just like, when did she suddenly? And she didn't even last that long in the Rumble back in January.
She debuted on Raw on May the 24th, 2010. 10 years ago!
You know, if you're not going to get over in nearly 10 years, it's not going to happen for you. I'm sorry. It just isn't.
But it baffles me that, you know, there's a worldwide pandemic, right? Roman Reigns doesn't want to wrestle. Shit's hitting the fan. The stock price is going down. Got to remember to push Tamina, though.
I mean, it's hardly an antidote, is it, to, like, you know, economic collapse? Bloody hell. So, I mean, I was just astounded by this. I was just thinking, well, have I missed something here? Did Tamina score this big win? You know, when did she suddenly become this, you know, obviously it's a word you can't use in reference to, well, I'm not going to even go down that road. When did Tamina become this destroyer of opponents?
It's just, when did you she said become the, you said
this titan of the ring? And I have no idea when this happened. You know, maybe it happened on main event and I just wasn't watching.
Do you know, I know I'm being probably fairly horrible. Whenever she's been on like Total Divas and stuff, she actually seems like a fairly nice person and fun and whatever. But like, it's just never translated to TV.
No.
You know, the best run that she had was probably was she AJ Lee's bodyguard? She was somebody's bodyguard.
I mean, this is the thing. None of it is memorable, is it?
Yeah, the idea that I can't remember whose bodyguard she was. She definitely was somebody's bodyguard. Was it Night? She was AJ Lee's bodyguard. So she came back in September 2013 and she was AJ Lee's bodyguard. That was probably the most memorable thing that she did.
I can't even remember that.
Well, if you don't remember that, Finn, you don't remember anything that she did. She was also in Team Bad, which was beautiful and dangerous, along with Sasha Banks and Naomi, I think it was.
Okay.
Was it Sasha Banks? Yeah, because remember Stephanie came out and she brought out Becky Lynch, Charlotte and Sasha, all from NXT, and she put them into little teams.
Right.
No, right, okay. This is the noise of Finn Martin not remembering anything.
I mean, you know, I can remember like all the WWF and WWF heavyweight champions in order for the first 20 years of the company's existence, or probably even the first 25 years.
Well, it's not going to help you with your Tamina Snuka knowledge, is it?
Well, I mean, Tamina Snuka's... I mean, I don't think, you know, I don't think in the future I have a job as Tamina Snuka's biographer. I think that is... we've established that today. Very clearly.
Although I would watch a show on you follow it. Are you, like, driving around towns with Tamina Snuka? Like, how will we broach all of the things related to Tamina Snuka in a book?
I mean, it's just like, I'm just bored thinking about it. It's so tedious and monotonous. And she's just like, I mean, she really is. She's like, you know, wood chip wallpaper painted magnolia. That's what she is.
No, do you know what she's like?
What?
She's like mild cheddar. Just tasteless, nothing there, no point to it.
Yeah. Or granola without sugar on it.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Sugar-free granola. Have you ever tried that? So
why did you try sugar-free granola?
I have no idea. It was just something I tried one time, and it was like eating grit. But Tamina's just got no pizzazz. There's nothing exciting about her. There's nothing dazzling, no energy, style, flair. There's just nothing there. And she's pushed as a star of this segment, for Christ's sake. Bloody
Bailey and Sasha Banks were retreating from Tamina.
From Tamina, yeah. 8 days before WrestleMania. I mean, apparently WrestleMania is too big for one night, and this is a WrestleMania that involves Tamina Snuka. I don't think so. There's no truth in packaging there.
Well, let's move on. I think we've battered her character enough, figuratively.
I think we've worn that one out. I think that joke has now expired.
But although if she ever does bring out a no pizzazz t-shirt, I will 100% buy it full price on Euroshop. Drew Gulak faced Shinsuke Nakamura, and if Drew Gulak managed to beat Shinsuke Nakamura, then Daniel Bryan would get a shot at Sami Zayn for the Intercontinental Championship at WrestleMania. Drew Gulak does get the win. They keep it short.
4 minutes this match lasted.
4 minutes. I've got to say, the Drew Gulak and Daniel Bryan partnership is a lot of fun. In these dark days, it is something fun, and I'm appreciative of that.
I am. What I don't appreciate is why this match was so short. You know, we're at a time when we need content to fill up the programmes. And, I mean, I know Nakamura has reached the point now where you can't even be bothered. There isn't even a sense of disappointment about him anymore. We're far beyond that. You know, that was like last year or 18 months ago, you know, when we were disappointed by the way in which Nakamura was booked. It's now expected that it's just going to be, you know, dull and filler and uninteresting and... You know, ultimately, I mean, I know this match wasn't inconsequential per se, because obviously it has served a purpose, which was if Drew Gulak defeated Shinsuke Nakamura, then that would entitle Daniel Bryan to a match with Sami Zayn for the Intercontinental title at WrestleMania. So the match did serve a purpose, but my God, it was these two guys, Nakamura presumably still has some talent. We don't see much in the way of it on TV anymore. But, I mean, you would think that these two could have, like, a really good 8 or 9 minute match. Why not book this match to go 8 or 9 minutes and, you know, give us a match to remember in order to set up this WrestleMania match? I'm just baffled by that. I'm just not baffled by the outcome, but just baffled by the fact the match only lasted 4 minutes. I just can't explain that at all.
Well, I mean, that was, you know, Shakespearean compared to the thing that baffled me. Can I tell you the thing about SmackDown that baffled me the most?
Would it be Elias and King Corbin?
No, even more than that.
Please tell me.
So, the last kind of 2 or 3 months, they have done a very good job of reminding me of what a killer Asuka is. Becky Lynch matches, she's the one woman that Becky Lynch couldn't beat. She, you know, Shayna Baszler's the one woman that caused Shayna to break a sweat. Like, she has been presented to us as, you know, the monster that she is. And Alexa Bliss hits her with a shite DDT. 1, 2, 3, that's it. Like, I like Alexa Bliss, but there is no world, whether it's tag team division or singles, where Alexa Bliss should be booked in any way convincingly to beat Asuka. It's it's unbelievable. It's not... I don't buy it, and I just think it's another example of, like, you did all this work to build Asuka back up again, and you've just, you know, shat the bed again for no reason when you didn't have to. I mean, nobody is going to buy WrestleMania more because Alexa Bliss beat Asuka. But at the same time, in 3 months when you want Asuka to be a big deal, it might not feel like a big deal because you just jobbed it out in just such a lazy, cliched, boring way.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, it's just scatterbrain booking, isn't it? I mean, you know, which space cadet, you know, greenlit this?
And this match was 10 minutes. Why was this 10 minutes and Gulak and Nakamura was 4?
I just don't get it. I mean, you know, the most memorable part of this to me, apart from the outcome, was Nikki Cross on commentary. It was attempting to be a Scottish version of Asuka when she was on commentary. With this just constant chatter. And it was as if Nikki took it upon herself to just fill the void by the absence of the audience. You know, she's thinking, right, there's no heat, there's no noise coming from the audience. So I just need to fill in for all of them. So I'm just going to keep talking. And that's what she did. So, I mean, that kind of overshadowed the match. And then, as you say, then we had this clean outcome with Alexa Bliss scoring a win remarkably easily over Asuka, who was, as you say, this person that Becky Lynch wasn't sure if she could defeat. This person who's been not presented as invincible, but presented as someone who's really tough, and loses to Alexa Bliss. And by the way, where's Kairi Sane? We haven't seen her since March the 9th, as far as I can work out. Where is she? And this match is taking place. Alexa Bliss and Nikki Cross versus Asuka and Kairi Sane is taking place at WrestleMania. Obviously, it's already taken place, but it is taking place at WrestleMania. So presumably she's available. Why has she not been appearing at ringside? Why has she not been participating?
It doesn't make a lot of sense. I think in real life she got married, and I think that she, I mean, not that this is any shock to him, but I think that she plans to basically go back to Japan when her contract's up. I mean, why would you stay? What's
indeed
the point? You know, if you're going to leave your own, like, you know, culture, and you're going to move to, you know, a place where Donald Trump rules, then you'd want to do it for some very creative fulfillment that you get. And to not be fulfilled creatively, you know, she's probably just going to want to go home and just spend time with her husband and wrestle in Japan, where she can just kind of do her own stuff and not really have to be produced that much. So yeah. I think the writing's on the wall for her, and I think she's just going to be gone soon.
So what you're saying is that Alexa and Nikki Cross are probably going to win the tag team title. Are you spoiling that one for us, Kenny, and all the listeners?
I mean, look, it wouldn't surprise me to see Asuka take another pinfall. Because, of course, they'd have Asuka take the pinfall rather than Kairi saying who's probably going to leave.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that would actually be sort of logical, given, you know, the current reverse logical sort of environment in which we find ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, and can I just say earlier when I made that reference to make WCW great again? I mean, WCW, you know, just talking about this thing from back in 2000 when it was going to be Bischoff and Vince Russo, you know, they could have sold hats and T-shirts and everything. They missed out there, Kenny.
They were ahead of the game and they just didn't follow it through. But you did also bring up the Elias and Corbin stuff. I mean, this was, you know, the camera work here, the sort of, you know, Spielberg-like shots. I mean, I don't know about you, but, you know, Elias and Corbin is definitely still a meaningless and pointless
main
match.
Main event in any building, on any show, anywhere in the country, as Gorilla Monsoon would have said.
If Gorilla Monsoon and Bobby Heenan came back from the dead, even they couldn't sell you this. And that's the testament, because they're so good. I mean, Elias, him being a babyface, he's just lost all of his cool factor.
Yeah.
Corbin's out there with a crown that would challenge Sheamus for stupidity of crowns. Yeah. I mean, WrestleMania. Elias versus Baron Corbin one-on-one. Are they on drugs?
I mean, really, some people are probably, you know, getting some sense of satisfaction from this after the, you know, seeing the Corbin-Kurt Angle match at WrestleMania last year. Probably think, well, he deserves that for, you know, beating Kurt Angle in Kurt Angle's final match. But I mean, this was just terrible. You know, I mean, Elias sings a song. You know, it's a ditty about King Corbin, the theme of which is toilets. And we've got toilet paper emblazoned with images of Corbin's face. We've got references to feces. We've even got an image of Corbin sat on the toilet. I mean, the lyrical content of this song, what was it, Kenny?
I mean, I'm going to have to go with the old Bret Hart score, 4 out of 10.
Oh, no, I mean, the lyrical content of this was shit. That's what it was. I mean,
oh, yeah, it was atrocious. It was
terrible. And then, Elias is on the perch, and then Corbin turns. We've had a lot of people attacking people from behind recently. Have you noticed that?
They're probably just bored because they're stuck in a performance centre with nobody there. I'll just attack somebody to pass the time.
Maybe the vending machine's knackered. You know, that's probably it, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, remember this past Sunday when the clocks went forward and nobody fucking noticed because they were just all so depressed? I saw somebody say, the clocks are moving forward. Can you move them forward 3 months?
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Please.
So, I mean, you know, Corbin turned up, attacks Elias, then whacks him with his scepter. And then we went to this shot of Elias falling off the perch. Then went to another shot, overhead shot of Elias lying on the arena floor. And it's so hokey. I mean, it's just, it was like it was intended to be just, and I don't like using the F word in pro wrestling. The F word is a word I do not like using in connection with pro wrestling. Because to me, it's an offensive word in connection with pro wrestling. But I'm sorry, this looked fake. It just did, you know.
And it did.
I mean, it just looked, you know, in the parameters of pro wrestling, that is, this had no place on a wrestling show. It was like it was designed to be idiotic. And it's like Elias, if you think about it, you know, WWE is all about, you know, it's all about trying to put on a show that's, WWE has its way of doing things, you know, it's big on the psychology and all those type of things. Now, the psychology here of Elias falling off that perch, not landing on a crash mat, but landing on the floor, he shouldn't be able to wrestle at WrestleMania this coming weekend, should he? Because he's just taken this big fall, this big bump onto a arena floor.
So, do you know, when Earthquake sat on Hulk Hogan, it took him 4 months to get back.
Exactly.
Elias was murdered, and he'll be fine in 10 days, or 8 days, whatever it is.
Exactly. I mean, hopefully they'll at least base the match around Corbin attacking the back. Yes. That is the only way that this can be, there can be any sort of excuse for what they did here, that they work this into the story. I mean, I wonder if they will. I hope they do.
Yeah, I hope they do. I mean, and the other thing on SmackDown that's worth noting was the Bray Wyatt. I thought the Bray Wyatt Funhouse was very good.
Yes.
We'll see what the Firefly Funhouse match is going to be. I sense a clusterfuck, but we shall see. We shall see where it goes.
I mean, I thought it was great. You know, Bray Wyatt's there, and was it Abby the Witch saying, "Do you have the recipe to defeat John Cena?" It's like, well, actually, I do. You know, light bulb appears above his head. You know, rage and resentment. You know, what we need is some rage and resentment. You know, self-loathing. You know, disappointment. You know, all these sentiments that all of us have when we watch a John Cena match. And the rambling rabbit turns up with a carrot and says, you know, put this in there so you can see John Cena. Wyatt's just hilarious. You know, that's the last thing I need. You know, some irrelevant and unnecessary opinions, or hurls the carrot in the air. And then poor rambling rabbit ended up in the blender.
Most of John Cena's opponents have ended up.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. You know, but quite literally ends up in the blender. And he drinks the concoction. And the light bulb then went above his head. Sorry, I got ahead of myself there. He drank the concoction and then he had the light bulb moment. And Wyatt challenged Cena to a Firefly Funhouse match at WrestleMania. And we learned later in the show that Cena will answer that challenge on this week's SmackDown, which I'm assuming he will. I'm actually looking forward to this Firefly Funhouse match. I would rather see this than a straight match between these two. Because, and I think probably it's going to be good for Cena in all seriousness, because it means that he can do some low-risk stunts. And there's a lot of things they can do to minimise the risk of him suffering an injury. And I said this weeks ago when he came back. This is obviously something that, even though movies are not, you know, movies have been suspended right now. I mean, the whole sort of Hollywood's pretty much shut down. So Cena's probably not going to be doing anything for a while. The last thing he wants to do in the wrestling ring is suffer an injury or put himself in a position where he can't work if filming does resume on whatever project he's going to be working on next in, say, late May or early June. So I think this is a good outcome for everyone, the Firefly Funhouse match. It's going to be somewhat different. And it means as well that in the event The Fiend wins, which one has to assume he will, you know, it's going to be via some loony means, some zany means. So Cena's kind of got an excuse for losing. And, you know, it'd be somewhat different. It'd be different to what they've done previously. So I'm all on board for this.
So over on Raw, though, we had some, you know, it was a fairly promo-heavy show. They opened the show with The Undertaker doing his best promo in years, where he, you know, addresses AJ by his real name, and he talks about, you know, you were a big fish in a small pond, and, you know, you waited till all the Rock and Kurt Angle and all that were gone. You waited, you know, except me. Insults him, says that Michelle McCool did a better Styles Clash than him. Try me, I'll make you famous. The thing that was, I mean, I thought this was an excellent promo from Undertaker. The thing that kind of annoys me a day later thinking about it is that, like, The Undertaker still has it to cut these kind of promos, and it kind of really showcased how lazy they are with him all the time, because, and even in the presentation of this feud, can you imagine what it would have meant if Undertaker, say The Undertaker, the Dead Man, had made the big return at Super Showdown, and he came out and AJ Styles beat him straight away, you know, in Saudi Arabia, and then, you know, The Undertaker's questioning himself, and then AJ's cutting these promos, and then suddenly there's a story, and Undertaker's got a point to prove. But because he's already beat him and then interfered in the Aleister Black match, this promo doesn't kind of make any sense given what story we've had so far. So it's just kind of all a bit jumbled up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, scatterbrained. And the thing is, had he lost to Styles at some point, or Styles had left him laying, really done a number on him, it would have, you could say, I'm sure Vince's argument would be, well, that would have humanized The Undertaker. We can't do that. But then they've done that in all the promos. You know, with the, you know, image, the YouTube video of him and Michelle at the sanctuary with the tiger and all the other comments about Undertaker being Matt Calloway and being married to Michelle McCool. So we've already humanized him. So why not do that and then have like a redemption story where Undertaker's like this, you know, old gunslinger, you know, coming back for one last showdown, you know, to prove that he's still got it. I mean, that's the character he's been playing for years. And you've got a comeback story there, and you've got something that, you know, for us to root for. And also you've got an element of doubt over who might win this match. Because, I mean, who really believes that Styles is going to win? I mean, how can we? I mean, you know, even when they did the contract sign, and in the other week, Styles wouldn't go to the ring to present the contract to Undertaker. He sent Gallows and Anderson, who were then beaten down. I mean, Styles is there effectively cowering in the back. So, I mean, it's just...
You mean the two ass clowns that the Undertaker wants with AJ?
Exactly.
At WrestleMania?
Exactly. So, I mean, the fact that Michelle McCool was mentioned here in this promo, I'm convinced that she's going to make an appearance in this Boneyard match. She's going to be involved on some level. They wouldn't have brought up this many times if she wasn't going to be a participant.
Now, Finn, if you're a respected journalist, you've seen it all, but I need to ask you, if you're sitting watching WrestleMania this weekend or whenever you watch it, if Michelle McCool turns up, would that pop you? That's the key question.
Well, now that I've said that I want her to be there, of course I do, because I would like to be right about this. I'm still trying to climb myself out of that hole over the whole Tamina business earlier in the podcast, where I completely forgot every aspect of her career. You know, I'm supposed to have a good memory. You know, when you get to my age, you know, you don't want people to think you're losing it.
So well, I've got a way. We can fix this all right now. Okay, I've got an idea. Here we go. Who defeated the Iron Sheik to become the WWF champion in December of 1983? January of 1984. January of 1984, who beat the Iron Sheik to become the WWF champion in Madison Square Garden?
It was the incredible Hulk Hogan.
There you go.
Of course.
Exactly. You've not lost it. You've still got all that real knowledge that you need. So you don't remember who Team Bad are. So you don't remember the Submission Sorority, and then they had to change the name because it was a porno group for Page and Co.
Oh, yeah, it was. That was a classic, wasn't it, that one? Actually, the whole Hogan thing at MSG with the Iron Sheik, his entrance, I think it's on YouTube or Daily Motion. If you haven't watched it recently, just go back and watch Hogan's entrance when he comes out to Survivor's Eye of the Tiger and watch how he pumps up that crowd. And bear in mind, Hogan had only returned to WWF the previous month. So he'd been back for less than 4 weeks in the WWF territory. And just look at the reaction he gets. Just witness the reaction he gets from that MSG crowd. It's incredible. You know, worth checking out.
That was the Undertaker promo. I guess we'll see if Big Michelle shows up this weekend at the Boneyard match.
She's going to be there.
We also got Becky Lynch doing a promo after we saw the triple threat match from WrestleMania 35 last year. It does not hold up, sadly.
It dragged on and on. That match just dragged. I mean, I didn't watch it all because, I mean, why would you want to watch? Why would you want to sit through it again? But my God, it dragged on. I mean, by all means, show highlights of these matches, but not all of them. We don't need to see it all again. It's like when they showed the Roman Reigns versus Triple H match from, was it WrestleMania 32, I think it was,
yeah,
wasn't it?
32, yeah.
And like, years ago, they would have sound sweetened, like they often did with various people. And I've forgotten just how savagely Roman Reigns was booed in that match, and he was supposed to be the babyface, and the crowd was just all over him. This match here with Rousey and Charlotte and Becky Lynch, I just can't believe that they screened the whole damn thing. And they even screened Joan Jett playing Ronda Rousey to the ring as well. So, yeah. And then right after that, we had the Shane and Lynch angle, which I'm going to talk about now. But moments later, we had the Shawn Michaels and Ric Flair Snickers moment from 2000, the Snickers moment from 2008, WrestleMania 24. And we just had highlights of Michaels versus Flair. And I know that was an altogether different match and was obviously very well received on the night, but that just played so much better, showing it in highlight form rather than showing these entire matches that didn't get over on the night. I just don't get it, Kenny.
It doesn't make any sense. It really doesn't. Becky Lynch cut a promo where she brings up Ronda Rousey.
Yes.
And she mentions that, you know, Shayna Baszler's going to have the chance to either steal Rousey's spot if she beats her, or stay in her, get put back in Ronda's shadow if she loses. Shayna then attacks her from behind, puts the Kira for the Clutch on, eventually releases her, picks up the belt, and then drops it onto Becky and leaves. It was fine, but it just does not scream. Just like most stuff does, sadly, does not scream.
WrestleMania.
But it's hard to get excited about it because you know you're not. You know, part of the excitement of a WrestleMania is what the atmosphere is going to be like when you go to a particular match, and because you know there's no atmosphere, it's just difficult to get excited. But I thought the performers here did a good job of, you know, executing what they were trying to do.
Yeah, the only thing I didn't really like about it was just like a reverse of what happened the previous week, you know, where we had Shayna doing the interview with Charlie, and then Becky turns up with the chair and Undercover Darkness, and obviously everything on Raw now is tight shots. You know, all the going in close, so we don't have those big wide shots of the arena to illustrate or emphasize that no one's there. So, I mean, it just felt like a repeat of that, and almost like Becky should have really expected reprisals after what she'd done to Shayna. And that was, you know, sometimes you think, well, why are babyfaces that stupid? Because if I was in Becky's position, I would be expecting an ambush from Shayna, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I mean, after what she'd done the previous week. So why not just have her there in a position where she can't be ambushed or sort of walking, you know, turning around just to make sure no one's behind her. And that would have also been a little bit selling to sell in the threat posed by Shayna, as much as the attack that Shayna inflicted upon Becky. I think something like that would have been a really nice touch.
Yeah,
so, stuff like that.
It would have been good. We also got Kevin Owens and the Street Profits beating Seth Rollins, Angel Garza, and Austin Theory, who's coming in to sub for Andrade while he's injured. The babyface has got the win, but the big story here has to be, oh my God, Montez Ford's botched dive thing.
It was just, what the hell was that?
Like, I mean, I've said a couple of times on this podcast, or in the podcast with Sondra, you know, that a couple of the Jurassic Express matches have had kind of, you know, botched moments, and I think that's kind of unacceptable. And I think it's, you got to say it here as well, like, you know, you shouldn't be seeing this kind of stuff. You know, or at least, at the very least, if something happens where somebody misses something, you just like roll with it.
Yeah.
Like, don't sell something that doesn't hit you. Like, it reeks of like, this is mapped out and I can't deviate from what I've, you know, got in my mind.
Yeah. I mean, this was a taped show, right? This wasn't live, was it?
Yeah. Taped.
So, I mean, why did he do that on a tape show? I mean, it appeared that Seth Rollins was supposed to trip Montez Ford as he was coming off the ropes, and Rollins blew it and did not trip him. Why, as I wrote this on my Facebook page, why didn't Ford then just run across the ring, bounce off one set of ropes, then bounce off the set of ropes that he just bounced off or rebounded off to allow Seth Rollins another shot of tripping him? Why didn't he do that? That would have taken, what, an extra 7 to 10 seconds? It's a tape show anyway. And instead, he just carried on regardless and did this flip dive to the floor in the direction of Austin Theory, who was, you know, neither in position to catch Montez Ford, nor even looking at Montez Ford when Ford took off. So he does the flip dive, comes down on his back, and no one's broken his fall. And it's a flat back bump on the metal ramp. Totally unprotected fall. On his Twitter page, Montez Ford joked, you know, put like an interview with Mike Tyson on there, in which Mike Tyson said he'd broken his back. And Montez Ford said, you know, this is what I said to my mother when I spoke to her last night. I've broken my back. I don't think he did break his back, but my God, I mean, that was an unnecessary risk. And just, I mean, he's been around wrestling long enough now that he should have been able to improvise. I just don't understand why he didn't do that and why he put himself in such danger. And also, it was possible that as he was doing the dive, Austin Theory might have been inclined to sort of, when he wasn't ready, trying to catch Montez Ford, and he could have been injured trying to catch Ford. In the end, he didn't, and Ford just took this bump, and hopefully he's going to be all right. I mean, I'm sure somebody in the back, or more than one person in the back, will be having very stern words with Ford about this, that move that he did, and explaining to him that he should never do that again.
Yeah, he should just, that, you should never see that. And like, I mean, on a taped show, it just, surely somebody could have called an audible of like, hey, just do that again. Like, just, there's nobody in the room, there's no crowd, just redo it. We also got really killer promos from Edge, Kevin Owens, and Paul Heyman. Hyping, you know, the big three matches with Orton and Edge and Owens and Rollins and Lesnar and McIntyre. I thought all the promos were very good. I'm kind of mystified that McIntyre wasn't allowed a bit of promo time on this go-home show.
Yeah.
But I thought the three of them did a pretty decent job. You get Kevin Owens talking about how, you know, kind of rebutting Rollins' promo last week. And how he's going to be the one to burn it down this weekend. They've got their history of, you know, Kevin Owens being the kind of performance center guy when Rollins saying he's the guy that built the performance center. You get Edge talking about he's the guy with the grit that's going to take Orton down, and Orton's at his best when he's around, and he's going to push him into a hole, and, you know, he's going to push him into a hole and
never pull him out. He's never going to help him out this time.
Yeah, he's not going to pull him out. And then you've got obviously Heyman giving the hard sell to the Drew and Brock match, closing it with what was it he said? You'll become nothing. You'll be the guy that came up short in WrestleMania, and you'll walk in special and walk out just like everyone else. Nothing more than Brock's bitch. So I thought the promos were good, and they were. I hope that coming out of these empty arena shows, what WWE start to do is just let guys and women cut promos without sort of like, you know, stupid interviewers going, I've got to ask you, how do you feel about the idea you were attacked last week? Like, you know, stupid questions. These are much better.
Yeah. Yeah. None of these promos felt scripted, did they? They all felt like this was their own words. I mean, obviously, no one's scripting Paul Heyman's promos for him.
Yeah, I can't believe... Like, pardon the pun, they felt raw.
Exactly. They felt real, they felt genuine, they felt like they were these performers' real emotions in the context of pro wrestling about their performers. You know, they've got fully into character here. This isn't somebody handing a script, you know, that doesn't really understand the character and say, you know, read this aloud on the pre-tape. It's like these are... three or four perfect. Well, actually, it was only three people talking. Brock Lesnar didn't say anything as usual. This was three guys who've been doing this a very long time, who know what to say, how to say what they know how to get over their emotions, their sentiments to an audience in a way that is unique to them. And I thought Kevin Owens did a really good job. He needed a strong performance after the way in which Seth Rollins really put him down on last week's Raw. I mean, that was a pretty brutal burial of Owens by Rollins on last week's Raw. So Owens needed to come back swinging here. And I thought he did a tremendous job. Just the tempo and the intensity just gradually increased and just became more forceful and aggressive. And when it ended, you really felt like this was a guy that was gunning for Rollins and wanted to put him in his place and really wanted this match and wanted to win and that it really mattered to him. This match was the most important thing to him in years, and that defeating Rollins, you know, losing was not an option. He was going in there to win because he had to win. So I thought Owens did really well. The Edge promo, you know, I'm having a hard time really maintaining interest with Edge. I don't know why. I'm looking forward to this match just happening. I just feel like this was a promo too far for Edge. Didn't really need to hear this one. I feel like he said everything he needs to, but I do get that it was very intense. It was from the heart. It was consistent with everything they've said previously. It was furthering the story and the hatred, you know, the conflict between the two. So I'm not saying that there was anything about this that was amiss or was a fail. I just kind of feel like I've heard all I need to from Edge and Randy Orton, and I just want to see him fight now, which I guess is really a credit to them, because they've already, I think, done an exemplary job of promoting this match. So, you know, that's not really a criticism. That's just my personal taste. I can understand why people would have enjoyed it. And obviously, Heyman did a tremendous job as well in the main spot. The only thing missing, as you said, was Drew. Would have been nice to see an appearance from him at the end, just to come out on the ramp and even just to glare at Lesnar and Heyman. I think that would have been the perfect, you know, that would have been the icing on the cake there. That would have been the perfect finishing touch to the Heyman and Lesnar promo. Instead, they just went with like a close-up of Lesnar's face. And as Heyman spoke and his intensity grew, then the camera grew ever more close to Lesnar's face, and he had the expression right down and he's meaning business. So I thought that was well done. So yeah, I think, you know, definitely the promos were the highlights of this week's Raw by a mile. And I think they overall did do a good job on the promos of promoting the matches. Although, as we've done, we've kind of picked holes in some of those promos.
And next week, obviously, in the podcast, we will pretty much be reviewing both nights of WrestleMania and, you know, were they able to put something together that will stand the test of time? It's not looking hugely in their favour for that. But, you know, we'll go in. The thing that they've got going for them is that a lot of people want a WrestleMania and a lot of people want some escapism. So, you know, people are going to be sitting down this weekend on Saturday night, Sunday night, and just want to be entertained. So hopefully they can find a way, you know, hopefully just the idea that it's WrestleMania, you know, peps them up to do something that will be gushing about next week. The last thing I wanted to bring up, though, on the...
Was it? I know what it was. It was the trailer for the Big Show show. That's what you wanted to bring up, wasn't it?
No, absolutely not. Although I do think that we should, because the first episode of the Big Show show premieres on Netflix next week. Okay. Maybe we should watch an episode.
Yeah, it's probably only going to be like 30 minutes. I can't imagine it's going to be any longer than that. So
probably about 27 minutes more than we need. But yeah, we'll give it a watch. Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't deserve the right to take any more of our lives than that.
No, it barely deserves that. But we will try and give it some time.
I mean, to me, it looks feeble, and I cannot believe that Netflix has put their stamp on this. It looks terrible.
Yeah, I would be amazed if this lasts more than a season. Like, amazed, but we'll see. The last thing I wanted to bring up, though, was the Dark Side of the Ring series has started on Vice in the US, Crave in Canada, and last week they started off with the double premiere edition of season two, talking about Benoit. It was a two-hour episode. We've both watched it. I know that you've covered the Benoit thing at length at the time and then in Pro Wrestling through the Power Slam years. What did you make of the documentary? I thought it was heavy, and it was, you could tell that the producers and the people who did it put a lot of work into it. And I think that it is something that kind of is accurate enough that I think that it kind of, you can sort of be proud that you did it if you're somebody who put it together. But what did you make of it?
I think, as you say, there was a tremendous amount of work went into this. They had rounded up a lot of very relevant talking heads, you know, David Benoit, Chavo Guerrero, Dean Malenko, obviously Chris Jericho. Vicky Guerrero was a big part of it. Dean Malenko's wife. I thought she had some valuable contributions. She wasn't in there much, but she did contribute a lot to this. Nancy's sister,
Sandra.
I mean, she was one of the stars of it, I felt. I thought she had a lot to offer as well. They got Larry Alden, who was the detective in charge of the case and one of the first officers in the house in Fayette County, Georgia. After that fateful weekend in June of 2007. Chris Nowinski, I thought, really contributed a lot. I mean, he didn't really say anything that I didn't already know. But I mean, he's such a genuine guy, as Chris Nowinski. He's somebody who so wants to help the wrestling community and all sports people who are involved, in contact sports that can cause head trauma. And I just think that's a guy who's, I've got so much respect for Chris Nowinski. And that was quite interesting as well, where he was saying that Benoit had, he'd sat down with Benoit early 2007, I think it was, or late 2006.
I think it was early 2007.
And Nowinski was telling Benoit that he was going to do this study on it. And Benoit was like, well, please call me when you do. And Nowinski had asked Benoit, how many concussions do you think you've had? And he said, more than I can possibly count. And then it wasn't news that Benoit had severe brain damage from all the blows to the head that he'd received during his career. I mean, this was well known back in the late 2000s. But I thought Nowinski was a very valuable contributor to this. I thought he really had a lot of weight to it. There was parts of it that I didn't really like. I think there was a lot of deliberate omissions there. But at the same time, you can't cover everything.
What would you say? I mean, just for people, because there's a lot of people who watch this documentary who don't know the full story, or they just know bits and pieces. So what do you think, just for people who don't know, what were a couple of the big omissions that you would have liked to have seen in there that they didn't include, that are important to the story?
I don't think they really mentioned, Benoit was taking massive amounts of drugs, massive amounts of steroids. And like Phil Astin, his doctor was sentenced to 10 years in jail for illegally prescribing drugs to Benoit and many others. So, I mean, I don't really think that was mentioned enough, just the amount of drugs that he was doing and just But there again, you know, is that really that relevant? I mean, I think it is relevant to the story. It's tricky because, you know, a lot of people, a lot of the mainstream media at the time was trying to, they were trying to spread the word or the notion or floating the notion that this was a roid rage attack on by Chris on Nancy and on his son Daniel. And I think it is possible that there was, and in fact, not only possible, but I think it was probable that there was huge rage involved in the death of Nancy, but there wasn't with his son, because I think he sedated him first. So, I mean, that was kind of different, really, to the Nancy thing. So, I mean, was it really a roid rage attack or not? And if it wasn't a roid rage attack, then is Chrissy's drug use really relevant to the story? Is it more of a CTE thing? Is it a brain damage thing? And I kind of think it was. I think they did do a good job of explaining the effect that Eddie Guerrero's death had had on Chris. I thought that was one of the real achievements of this documentary, just really explaining how Benoit became so sort of reserved after Eddie's death and really struggled with everything, just became so withdrawn from others and just really started, for him, the death was so difficult to deal with. And I think that was a huge part of why he just fell apart emotionally and psychologically and everything else. But I mean, it's a tricky one. I mean, there's so many things about the whole Benoit story that you cannot cover them all in a 2-hour documentary. So it almost feels like for me to criticize aspects of it is unfair, because they were covering so much in this documentary here. You know, Chris's career, you know, from the Stampede days through, you know, New Japan and WCW and onto WWF / WWE. And there was quite a few omissions there. But I mean, they did mention some of the key stuff, like it was Sandra, Nancy's sister, who, you know, made joke at the time that Kevin Sullivan, who was the booker of WCW and was in a feud with Chris Benoit, and then encouraged Chris and Nancy, you know, they were put together as an on-screen couple, and then he encouraged those two to mix off-screen as well in order to convince people that they genuinely were a couple. That's something that Kevin Sullivan genuinely did do.
A buffoon.
Yeah, and then the joke was that Kevin had booked his own divorce, which was absolutely true. He did. So, I mean, that there, I think they did a really good job with that. But then they kind of fast-forwarded really to WWF, didn't really explain why they left WCW, you know, because obviously it had been Russo had come in and then he had quit in early January of 2000, and then they'd gone back to a committee with Kevin Sullivan, heavily involved in the booking committee at that point. That was just prior to Sold Out 2000. They gave Chris the WCW world title, and then he refused to accept it and then basically quit the next day. But I mean, they were saying that, oh yeah, Chris and Eddie, you know, they were not really treated as main eventers. They weren't really given they're due by WCW. Well, in his last appearance for WCW, Benoit won the world title. So that was a bit of a glaring omission there. But again, I'm being too picky, probably, because they really need to move the story along and they can't dwell on every little detail. So, yeah, I mean, I think they did a good job with it overall. I mean, there was a lot, I think, like, for instance, one really interesting part of it was Chris Jericho talking about the macho culture in wrestling in the 1990s, which was to take as much punishment as possible. Wrestlers did that to kind of prove how tough they were. And then they illustrated this with lots of brutal chair shots that guys like Bubba Ray Dudley and Chris himself were taking. And we know from covering Retro Raws just how shocking it is watching the amount of punishment that talent took back then. I mean, it is truly shocking to watch. So these reports that Chris had had more concussions than he could possibly count are absolutely believable, supported by the evidence that they put out there. I think it was another interesting comment made by David Benoit that after the tragedy, he was asked who from WWE reached out to you. And he said only Chris Jericho and Chavo Guerrero. And I was kind of not floored by that, because knowing how WWE put its defensive guard up right after it all happened, that is consistent with their behavior after the tragedy. But to hear him say that was, that really made an impression upon me. We had Sandra there, Nancy's sister, saying that Jim Ross was not welcome at Nancy's funeral. And Jim Ross saying, you know, he was the company representative who was sent, and he wasn't welcome there. He said that he just felt so uncomfortable. But I mean, that was a tough one for Jim. I really felt for Jim Ross there, because if WWE didn't have a member of its management there to show his or her respects, then they would have been accused of being cold and heartless. And he did go, and no one wanted him there. So I thought that was a really interesting detail as well. I mean, I think really overall, you know, the end with David and Sandra getting back to, you know, managing to reconnect, which had happened a few years earlier, hadn't it? I think it was Chris Jericho that had...
Jericho kind of facilitated them to, yes, to kind of reconnect.
Yeah, that's right. So they'd spoken some years back, and then there was footage of them there hugging, and they've got like a relationship again, which I think was really an uplifting note to sort of draw it to a conclusion on. And then Sandra was asked whether or not she could ever forgive Chris. And she said, you know, carrying around the burden of hate becomes exhausting. And she said, I can't forgive him today, but maybe I can in the future. And I thought that was quite hopeful as well. So, I mean, yeah, that was, they were really nice things to see, uplifting things to hear and witness on the show. But yeah, there were some weird things about it. Like, for instance, they were talking about the mainstream media's reaction to the tragedy, and really blasting the mainstream media for their coverage of it. And to me, okay, the mainstream media does have, certainly back then, I think they've become more accepting of pro wrestling now in 2020 than they were in 2007. But back then, if they could pummel the business, then they would. If there was an opportunity there to run the business down, then they would. But I mean, it wasn't, you know, I mean, look at what happened, and look at the amount of people that had died back then. And it was like, this was pointed out by many people back in the mid-2000s, late-2000s, if baseball or football or basketball had the drug problem that wrestling had and the death rate that wrestling had, it'd be front page news. And wrestling was kind of under the radar screen. And it only really took something like this for the mainstream media to pay attention. But to me, what really fueled the scorn from the mainstream media was, you know, WWE's reaction to it. They became so defensive. They were like obnoxious and aggressive and deceptive. You know, they're sending these guys like Mr. Kennedy and Chavo himself and John Cena on Larry King Live and all these people there. And they just did not come across well at all. It just felt to me like in many cases they were trying to bamboozle and mislead. You know, it was us versus them. I mean, remember when Vince made that appearance on Raw, I think it was, because two congressional committees had written to him to say that they're going to investigate WWE for its drug culture. And Vince is saying, well, why would two committees, why would one committee, let alone two, want to investigate WWE? And it was like this total failure to accept the reality. It's like no self-awareness at all of what has just occurred and how bad this looks. You know, when the police went into Benoit's home, they found so many drugs. I mean, he was using fantastic quantities of testosterone, and yet he was passing all his drug tests. So, you know, Vince and the WWE talent are going on mainstream media shows and saying, oh, yeah, we've got this really stringent drug testing policy. And they'll say, well, hold on a minute. You know, Chris was using massive quantities of steroids, and yet he passed all his tests. So how can you have a stringent drug testing policy? And no one, none of the WWE talent or staff were failing to grasp the contradiction there, which made them even more defensive. You know, it's like, and Vince was like, you know, it was whole us versus them, you know, WWE against the media and the outside world, you know, even the government. You know, when Vince was hauled before the Oversight Committee in December of 2007, he's questioning. There was not like even a scintilla of humility, never mind, you know, contrition about the failings of his company's drug policy. I mean, it's worth going and reading the minutes, you know, the transcript of that interview. I mean, it's just, I'll tell you all you need to know about Vince McMahon. So, I mean, I think overall, I think this was a really good documentary. I mean, there was just, you know, there was some holes in it. But, I mean, I think, you know, I'm being, I guess, maybe picky or pedantic or harsh on them because there was so much to cover. And I think they did a tremendous job of accumulating so much vintage footage, getting so many talking heads who were very close to Chris and had intimate knowledge of the subject to talk and contribute to it. I thought it was really quite an achievement, really, what they did, putting together the package of people and footage and quotes and text messages and information. Didn't really seem like there was that many errors in it. Quite a few omissions, but as I say, you couldn't cover everything. What did you think of it, Kenny?
I thought it was very, very, I don't know what the word, I don't want to say great, because great, it's not a great story. It was powerful. Powerful, yeah, is probably the word. It was very powerful. I thought it was very well done. I thought they were classy in the way that they covered it and tackled it. I don't think they went for the smut of the issue. A couple of things that just stuck out to me was, like, I sort of appreciate when Chavo Guerrero is talking about Eddie Guerrero and, you know, he died of a heart disease and you know, but to sort of say, you know, Eddie had a lot of his demons, and if you look at Eddie Guerrero from 2000 to 2005, you can see that Eddie had taken a lot of drugs, and that obviously was going to contribute to his death in 2005. But I get why, you know, Eddie had cleaned up his act, so you don't want to... It's tough to kind of admit that, like, he died due to a drug-related thing. But, you know, we saw this with a lot of guys, you know, guys like the Big Boss Man and Hawk and people like that who would die very early of heart attacks, which obviously, you know, they'd had high drug use in the past. And even, yeah, when you get clean, that's not a... If you get it too late, if you get clean too late, it can still get you.
The damage is already done. I mean, you know, Eddie... It is a medical proven fact that his steroid and human growth hormone usage contributed to his early death. That has been a proven fact. That did happen.
Yeah, and I totally get why Chavo might not want to say that, but I think it's important to the conversation to put that out there. The hardest parts for me to watch were watching the footage of Daniel as a young boy. And you know, seeing him and David and their sort of brotherhood, you know, the picture of, like, you know, Daniel holding on to David's, you know, t-shirt and stuff, and how close they were, that was really rough. The idea that Chris Benoit had murdered his wife and his son was going to sleep that night, not knowing that somewhere else in his house his mum had been killed.
Yeah,
that, to me, that was just really rough, and I didn't really. I've tried to not really look too far into some of the stuff because I just don't think, I don't need to know exact specifics, but the fact that, you know, they were saying that Nancy had been, like, tied up with cords and stuff, when it gets to that, I'm just going, that's versioning too much for me to have to get it, because I'm a visual person, so it's not good for me.
It was harrowing, wasn't it, when Dean Malenko's wife said that Chris broke her back, and, you know, that to me was one of the most powerful talking head moments, one of the powerful interviews of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
When she said that, and just
all you need to say when you say that, it tells you everything that you need to know. Yeah.
About what's going on. Absolutely. Just disturbing.
To your point earlier, I think that the thing with David Benoit that's so sad is that, you know, he still sees his dad as a hero, And I don't think it's fair for any of us to criticise him for that, because like we don't have a personal connection. It's not our father. See, I guess you would never know how to feel in that situation if it was your dad. Like, I just don't know. So I don't want to judge him for it. But I think the thing that's sad for him is that you can tell he loves wrestling, and you know him and Daniel wanted to be the WWF tag team champions and all this kind of stuff. And you know he unfortunately looks so like Chris Benoit and has the name. There's no way he can be involved in wrestling.
No,
there just isn't. And it sounds horrible, but you just can't. You know, you put a mask on him. It's 2020. People are going to know who's under the mask. And it's just, I feel bad for him that, you know, something that could really be a great escape for him is something that he can never really get involved in, because he just, it's just in his genetics that he looks too much like his dad, and those final days or weeks or hours, whatever you want to call it, that his dad had are going to define not only him, but define his son as well. And that's a shame. And then Sandra, I think she was the star of the show.
Yeah.
She was tremendous. You know, her sort of talking about how, you know, she regrets that, you know, she kind of let Nancy go back to Benoit. And, you know, just seeing her and David Benoit sort of connecting again, I feel like that was kind of the uplifting part that we needed at the end of it. Because there's not really a lot of other, you know, uplifting things to think about. But I think when you saw them, they're two people who needed each other, and they're the only two people who could understand the other. So I thought that was a really important part to have at the end.
Yeah, I mean, Sandra shouldn't really feel taking any blame for that. I mean, I do know what she means, but I mean, Nancy had her own self-determination. You know, she was acting her own volition, going back to Chris, and you've got to figure it would have happened. She couldn't stop her going back. I mean, I'm sure she tried to discourage her from going back and to leave him. But I mean, she was a woman of her own self-determination. And if she wanted to go back to Chris, she was going to go back there. Because they had, you know, look at the house, look at the Benoit house. They had the dream lifestyle on paper, you know, from a material standpoint. They had a big house, massive grounds. He was a big star on TV. Obviously, behind closed doors, things were not as, nowhere near as rosy as they seemed, as, you know, which is, you know, I'm talking about before this happened in June 2007. There'd been a lot of problems between Nancy and Chris prior to that. But it's, yeah, I think she was going to go back to him. So, I mean, I think she should try and forgive herself for that.
Yeah, 100%. But I think if you've not seen it, I mean, I don't know about you, I would thoroughly recommend it. I think that you want to make sure you're in the right headspace to watch it, because it's not something that you should be watching if you're having a bad mental health day or anything. But I think that it is powerful, and it is kind of, I think it kind of, it's a well-told version of the events that kind of gets you up to speed and doesn't sort of, you know, sensationalize a lot of stuff.
No, I don't believe it's exploitative at any point. I think that's also a huge achievement of it. And I don't think Chris Jericho or Chavo or any of them would have been involved in anything, willingly been involved in anything that was in any way exploitative. So I thought they struck a really good balance there between, I mean, there was no point was anyone glorifying.
No.
Anything that happened. No, I mean, that was something that Chris Jericho said at the start, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
He said, listen, if you're going to try and say that we're doing this, stop watching now, you know, go and do something else.
And, you know, even the one last bit I just want to mention that I thought was really touching was when David Benoit, you know, was clearly getting so emotional about his dad. And, you know, he knows that, like, you know, most people probably think his dad is a scumbag now because of what happened in those final hours. And that's going to be the legacy. And he's never going to be remembered as the great wrestler that he was before that. But when he breaks down and Chavo comes in to sort of give him a hug, you know, that just was, I think that was really important that he, you know, he, that was one of the two people from the wrestling fraternity that reached out to him. And, at least he had that. So,
definitely.
But yeah, check out everybody. I think it's worth a check.
I think it absolutely is worth checking out, without a doubt. It is, and just to reiterate, there's no way they could cover everything here. So I don't want to feel like I'm being pernickety or splitting hairs or being pedantic, and I know I can be that. I absolutely can, and I think they did a really good balanced job here. There were some omissions, but they couldn't cover everything. And I think what they did cover, by and large, they covered it well.
Yeah, and let us know if you think that you would like to see us watch other episodes of Dark Side of the Ring Season 2, because there's not a lot of wrestling on, so, you know, I think this one, this week's one's on New Jack, there's a few other ones. So if there's ones that you kind of think you'd like to hear us talk about, let us know. But when we come back, the next time we're here on the main feed will be us reviewing WrestleMania. But of course, you can get in on the action on Patreon at patreon.com/InsideTheRopes, where we're about to record an overrun, taking your questions on WrestleMania's past and present, and looking back at the issue 126 of PowerSlam from January of 2005, where, ironically enough, the number one wrestler on the PS50 is Chris Benoit for 2004.
Wow. That is a coincidence, isn't it?
Yeah. Spooky
That's
timing.
That's quite a coincidence. Yes, absolutely.
Finn, any plugs for us before we head off into the sunset?
No plugs at all. So, and yes, we do leave this podcast on a somber note, but that's the subject matter that we've just reviewed, and that cannot be helped.
Yeah, and I think to try and put something fluffy in at the end would be kind of dismissive to the topic. So, good discussion.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening, everybody. You can get Finn on Twitter at Finley Martin. Get me at KennyMC1985. We appreciate all your support. And Finn, this time next week, we will be here, hopefully, to talk about some things that excited us at WrestleMania. Maybe Tamina Snuka finally becoming the women's champion that she so richly deserves to be, apparently.
Well, exactly. I mean, it was a commanding performance on SmackDown last week. She's got momentum going into WrestleMania.
What a sentence. Just remember, everybody, actions speak louder than words.
Indeed.
Bye, everybody. If I be tonight, if I am sad tonight.